Okay. So before I start, I just want to acknowledge this shrine, actually. This very beautiful shrine that, particularly the ribbons that kind of emanate from the Buddha's hands and actually snake all the way around the room. So thank you, Gus and Sadaketu. It's very, very beautiful. And if I got time at the end, I'll kind of come back to the importance of that. But hopefully, I think it will emerge. I hope it will anyway. So, this evening I'm going to talk specifically about the first few weeks of the Buddha's life directly after his enlightenment. So directly after Siddhartha Gautama became the Buddha, became the awakened one. And in doing so, I am going to be talking about some historical events that actually kind of happened. However, at the same time, as Dani Utah kind of mentioned, the Buddha's story contains these legendary or mythical elements which help us to see the more universal significance of his life, or as Sangharakshita, our teacher, says, the inner spiritual dimensions of the events themselves. So in this way, the story moves from being about the life of one person to a universal archetypal story that has significance for all of us, because it points to the potential within all of us to awaken. And along the way, I'll share some of my own story. But to begin with, I'm going to do a very brief recap, probably about 3 or 4 minutes, of what happened last week, particularly for those of you who weren't here and over Christmas festivities might not have had a chance to watch the wonderful talks. But I would, this isn't a replacement for them, because they were so detailed and rich, and I would really encourage you to watch them. But I'll just do a brief recap on what has happened so far in our story of the Buddha. So the future Buddha was born Siddhartha Gautama into the Shakya clan, led by his father, around 2,600 years ago. The young Siddhartha grew up pampered with amusements and pleasures and luxuries. So he had a very worldly, material existence with no recourse to the spiritual. In due course, he was married and later had a son, Rahula. And yet we're told that despite all this, despite having all these things, he was not happy. He felt dissatisfied. He felt bound down by pleasure and property and family and power. So Siddhartha, feeling discontent with his life, makes a series of 4 visits to the city in his chariot with his charioteer, Chandaka. And on the first visit, he sees an old man. On the second, he sees a sick and diseased person. And on the third, a dead body. On each occasion, he asks Chandaka to explain what he is seeing. And on each occasion, Chandaka tells him, adding that one day, Siddhartha, just like everyone else, will be subject to old age, sickness, and death. The young Buddha-to-be is deeply troubled and sorrowful about the sufferings that is an inevitable part of life. Now, of course, we can take this account literally to suggest that Siddhartha had never seen or knew anything about old age, sickness, or death. Or we can focus on that inner spiritual dimension of the story, which is on these 3 occasions he saw old age, sickness, and death as if he were seeing them for the first time. And I'm sure that we can all resonate with that. I certainly know that I can. And then he went out on the 4th journey, and he saw a holy man walking down along the street with a begging bowl. He was calm and quiet and peaceful. Siddhartha Gautama was deeply impressed by the sight of the holy man. And returning to the palace, he reflected deeply on all that he had learnt. He saw the worldly pleasures on offer to him for what they were, distractions from a deeper understanding about the true nature of reality. Eventually, he concluded that, like the holy man, he too needed to go forth from the home to the homeless life. He too would devote himself to the search for truth, the search for reality, to an end to suffering. And we're told that he spent 6 years, some 6 years, wandering, meditating, and learning what he could from the teachers he met, strenuously determined to find what had been lacking in his pampered life at home. For a while, he even devoted himself to extreme asceticism, going without food and sleep in the hope that this would help him realise the truth. So a kind of torture of the body, something that was very much kind of practised at the time. He then realised on the point of near death that denying the body was not a useful practice, and turning his back on such practices, in remembering a childhood event where he had spontaneously fallen into a deeply pleasurable meditative state, he devoted himself wholeheartedly to meditation. And so, having had a little food to eat, he sat down under a tree on the banks of a river and made the resolution that he wouldn't rise from the spot until he was enlightened. So we're told that day after day, night after night, he sat there. And as he sat, he controlled and concentrated his mind. He purified it, suppressed and dealt with the mental hindrances, the defilements, the mythical story of Mara, which we heard so beautifully last week from Dana Utah. And on the night of the full moon of May, just as the morning star was arising, just as he fixed his mind on that star glittering near the horizon, full enlightenment arose. Siddhartha Gautama had become the Buddha, the fully awakened one. So this talk is about the period in the life of the Buddha immediately after his enlightenment, those first few weeks. It's a story about honour and respect and reverence and devotion and gratitude, both the Buddha's but also our own. It's a story that conveys something of the nature of the enlightened mind, the wisdom, the compassion, the energy, conveys it to us who are not enlightened or not yet enlightened. It's also a story that tonight will culminate in the first Dharma teaching, the first retreat, the first Buddhist Sangha. But before that, a little bit about myself. So, I was raised in a Catholic family, and up until my early teens, I was probably a fairly good little Catholic girl. I made my first Holy Communion. I used to go to confession regularly, and so forth. And I was reflecting on this, and I thought, well, I guess I probably did feel some sense of reverence, some sense of devotion to God. Although I can't really feel it, I can't remember the feeling of it, because I don't think it was particularly freely given, because it was strongly mixed with a sense of fear for me. I think the God that I learnt about, maybe not your God, but the God I learnt about, was a punishing, judgmental, kind of omnipresent one. Later in my adolescence, I kind of rebelled and rejected Catholicism. I rejected the existence of a God, and indeed all forms of religion. I kind of dismissed the idea that there was something or someone above and beyond me that was worthy of reverence and devotion. And I think this rejection was further fueled by an incredibly passionate and growing interest in the subject of sociology, which is a very rational, certainly the sociology I learnt and knew, was a very rational, materialist, modern discipline. Its kind of reason for being is to explain modernity. Now, sociology was for many years my passion. It became my career. It enabled me to critically deconstruct the society I lived in. It was a place for me to channel my anger and kind of rest assured I was a pretty angry person. So I was kind of channeling my anger at the injustices and the wrongs of society. So I think ideas of devotion or gratitude or reverence simply didn't kind of figure in my life in a particularly positive manner. Indeed, Dana Utah was talking last week about the opposite of reverence and devotion being cynicism. And I think it's probably fairly accurate to say that I felt pretty cynical about a lot of things. I felt pretty cynical about religion, spirituality, about the idea that there was anything beyond what I could see and touch and hear and smell. And it's this attitude that I brought to my first Buddhist retreat that Dana Utah mentioned 10 years ago, which kind of by now you might be wondering why on earth I decided to go on it. My reasons, I can assure you, were not at all spiritual. Not at all spiritual. It was near Christmas. I'd finished a relationship. I'd finished my therapy. I think I missed the therapy more than the relationship. Actually, I did. It was longer. But that's by the by. And I didn't want to be on my own. I didn't know what to do. I'd had plans and they'd all gone awry. And, some of you, apologies for this. I know some of you have heard this before, but it hasn't changed. So a chance listening one morning to Rabbi Lionel Blue on Radio 4 doing Thought for the Day suggested that if you were on your own at Christmas but didn't want to be, which you might want to be, then there were lots of things you could actually do instead. For example, go on retreat. I have no idea whether he meant this type of retreat. No idea. I also had no idea what a retreat actually was, but it sounded like something I could do. It spoke to me in that moment. So in my kind of typical manner, I kind of went upstairs, put the computer on, Googled retreat at Christmas time. 5 minutes later, I was booked on the LBC winter retreat, this retreat, for the first 5 days. I was going to learn to meditate. That sounded great. And as I told some of my sociology friends, who were kind of slightly alarmed at what I was proposing to do, that I had absolutely no intention of attending anything else. I'd learned to meditate, but if there was kind of ritual or devotional aspects of the retreat, I didn't know what that meant, but I thought there might be some, I wouldn't go to them. I was not about to become a Buddhist. So something utterly amazing did happen to me on that retreat, which even now I can't really articulate from a rational perspective. That retreat changed my life completely. I did love meditation. I was taught by Maitreya Bandhu and Subhadramati. I remember it very well. Likewise, the Dharma, the kind of little I understood of it, made perfect sense to me. It was, and I know it sounds cliched, but it was as if I'd always known it. And I'm kind of reminded of that saying about how the Dharma is caught, it's not taught. And I think that there was something of that. There was a spirit of that. I think I caught the spirit of the Dharma, even if not the letter of it at the time. It almost didn't matter so much. And yet, I was confused, I was puzzled, I was even bemused by the more devotional or ritualistic aspects of the retreat, which I did stay for, I did want to know about. But I didn't understand it. I really didn't understand why people were bowing and kneeling and making offerings to a statue of the Buddha. It seemed, I don't know, kind of quite irrational to me. I didn't understand, beyond perhaps a kind of cynical sociological reading of the situation, why seemingly sane and intelligent people would consciously choose to do this in the 21st century. It's really how I felt. It's like eat your words, isn't it? So some of you might resonate. You might resonate with the discomfort that I was feeling on that first retreat. Maybe you don't. But yes, I was watching people expressing their reverence and devotion to the Buddha on the shrine. I did feel that discomfort. Well, in trying to make some sense of it all, let's return to the story of the Buddha, to this newly awakened being who, by staying steadfast and true, had managed to conquer the forces of Mara and awaken to the true nature of reality. So what happened next? Well, we are told that he spent the first few weeks just sitting under the trees by the river, absorbing the experience he had just been through, opening up to it as fully as possible, as if he was just continuing to transform every aspect of his being. And that's so difficult to imagine, isn't it? I just kind of find it completely difficult to imagine what that might have been like for him after such an incredible experience. He'd just been through the most incredible thing that can happen to a human being. And I can only kind of weakly imagine what that must have been like. And again, when I was reflecting on this, for this talk, I was thinking around, well, what kind of experiences have I had that have been even slightly similar to that? I was thinking about my experience of ordination. I was thinking about particularly the time between private ordination and public ordination. So I kind of knew my name, nobody else did. And I remember I just needed that time of silent, peaceful, calm reflection to just be and absorb my experience of becoming this new person, Mahamani. Other times on quite long solitary retreats where meditation has gone very deep, I've needed plenty of space to just absorb without doing anything. And I think, you know, I really love the way in which Maitreya Bhanda and Dana Yuta constantly encourage us to sit and do nothing, to just sit and do nothing, to calm the mind and body, to absorb the effects of our meditation. So this period of absorption for the Buddha was absolutely necessary, but it's not without its own kind of, I don't know, dilemmas, which are in themselves extraordinary and inspiring, and also give us some insight into the newly enlightened mind of the Buddha. They are in themselves teachings. So the Buddha, he kind of fully understood, without conceit or false claim, the uniqueness of his experience of what he had been through. There was no one in the universe who was more accomplished than him in terms of both spiritual training, attainment, and understanding. And for the Buddha, this posed a kind of dilemma of sorts, because he recognised, I hesitate to use the word need, because I don't think we can really talk about a Buddha having needs, but for the sake of language, he recognised something in himself that wanted to revere, to show devotion to something or someone beyond himself. And yet there was no one. He was the Buddha, the one who had gone beyond being an ordinary human being. Now, I don't know about you, but I find this a truly remarkable and inspiring part of the story. He'd just gained enlightenment, he'd just awoken, and yet they had this concern about who he could pay honour and respect to. And reflecting on this, he realises that his object of reference is, of course, the Dharma. In some senses, there couldn't be anything else, and that he would spend the rest of his life paying honour and respect to it. So, even a Buddha needs something to honour and respect. So devotion and reverence is part of the enlightenment experience itself and continues to be. Sangharakshita, a teacher, puts it, the enlightened mind is a worshipping mind, example, a devotional mind, no less than it is a realized mind or a compassionate mind. It is a worshipping mind, no less than it is a realized mind or a compassionate mind. And I was thinking, this isn't an image of the Buddha that automatically springs to mind when I or we think about the Buddha, is it? It's more likely to be this one on the shrine, or these ones on the shrine. But here we have a different image, an image of the Buddha paying reverence, devotion, honouring, respecting the Dharma. So what does this mean to us? But first of all, it shows us that the Buddha was not claiming the Dharma as his own personal philosophy. That seems very important to me. It wasn't his own personal take on life. The Dharma exists as a set of universal laws or truths that exist beyond the individual, even if that individual is a Buddha. Instead, the Buddha reveres the object or content of his own experience of enlightenment. So that's one thing we can take from it, and that's incredibly powerful in itself. But it's not the only thing, there's many things, but I just want to focus on one more. So back to me on that first retreat, sitting in the shrine room, watching people bow and kneel and make offerings to a statue of the Buddha. So I did feel discomfort. I did feel some almost disdain, I think, for what I was witnessing. But also, or alongside, underneath those feelings, there was something else as well. As much as I was repelled by what I saw, I was attracted to it. And from my deeply rational, materialist, critical, cynical mind, that was deeply disturbing. It was. And yet that desire, that longing to kneel before the Buddha, to surrender myself to something or someone beyond myself, remained and grew. And I guess my question to you is, well, for those of you who do come up to the shrine and make offerings, I wonder if you can remember what it felt like the first time you bowed before the Buddha. Can you remember what that feeling was like? And for those of you who don't or have not yet done that, can you imagine what it might feel like? What it might feel like to do that? Well, I can still remember it very, very clearly. And I think I probably always will, because it was the moment that my life changed, took a direction that I had certainly not anticipated, but at the time it felt the most right thing that I have ever done in my life. And so, yeah, I didn't think that I was going to bow to the Buddha in front of lots of other people. That felt too public for me at that point. So on my last day of the retreat, I walked down the corridor to the classroom where it had been converted into a small shrine room and we'd been learning meditation there. And I went in and sat down and shut the door. I was on my own. And I lit the two candles and sat in front of the Buddha. And I just looked at this figure. And then, yeah, at some point, and I can still feel it, I can still feel myself sitting there, at some point feeling very nervous, feeling like I almost didn't have the right to do what I was about to do, but feeling scared, excited, and I did know that what I was going to do would change my life. So I got up and I bowed to the Buddha, then I knelt down and made an offering of incense and took my head to the floor. And I did leave that room knowing that I was a different person. I didn't know what that meant at the time. I really didn't. But I knew that I was a different person. And I think it was the seeds of honour and respect, reverence, devotion, whatever you want to call it, whatever feels comfortable to you. But they had grown, they had been planted, there was reverence and devotion to something, someone other than myself, beyond myself, had kind of been planted in that moment. So our spiritual progress is dependent on an ability to express reverence and devotion. And similar to the Buddha, it needs to include the Dharma, but it also needs to include the Buddha as well. And beyond that, our teachers, past and present, our lineage that takes us all the way back 2,600 years to the Buddha, the Sangha, past and present. So in some ways we need a focus, don't we, for our devotion, some higher object for one's inspiration. Someone we can look up to and revere. And without it, our spiritual progress will be severely limited or impeded. So we need to let go, to surrender, even offer up ourself to something that exists beyond that self, something that we are willing to serve and depend upon. And we benefit from this surrendering. So this is the Buddha that we direct our reverence and devotion to, a reverence that acknowledges that our respect for the Buddha as a human guide and teacher, but extends beyond that to include an understanding that if we are to truly give ourselves to something, it needs to be something that goes beyond our limited or mundane human understanding. So we need to fully open ourselves up to the fact that the Buddha both attained and came to embody something that goes way beyond our limited human understanding. So the Buddha wasn't a god in the theistic sense of the word, but in becoming the Buddha, he ceases to be an ordinary human being. He dwells in the sphere of the transcendental, to which we as yet have no direct access to, or at best maybe occasional glimpses of. And I think if we don't see the Buddha in this way, then we don't really see the Buddha at all. We don't really see the Buddha. So let's continue with the story of the Buddha. He had fulfilled his aspiration of enlightenment. But what next? It could have just ended there in a way, couldn't it? The Buddha spending the rest of his life in deep bliss and contentment, a solitary life of contemplation. Of course, if he had done that, there would be no Buddhism. We wouldn't be sitting here tonight together. We would not be on retreat. But at a broader level, the world would not have heard the Dharma, and the world would be a much poorer place for it. So there's the Buddha sitting, continuing to absorb the deep transformation that he's been through. A transformation resulting in him going beyond all that we take for granted as common sense, as real. So he's gone beyond this idea of time and space that we invest so much in. That distinction between self and other no longer has the meaning that we give to it. He's gone beyond clinging and craving, aversion and pushing away, beyond delusion and ignorance. And as he sits in this deep bliss and contentment, we're told that this thought arises in his mind. So what he wonders is whether this truth, this reality that he has discovered, which is so sublime, would ordinary people, as he puts it, their eyes covered with dust of ignorance and passion, will they see it? Will they see it? Is it better to perhaps remain silent, to carry on this life of contemplation? And we're told that Brahma Sahampati, this kind of mythical lord representing the world, appears and says, there are in the world at least a few people whose eyes are covered with little of the dust of the passions. They will surely understand the Dharma if you will only teach it to them. And we're told that a vision arises in the Buddha's mind, in which he saw people almost as different coloured lotuses in a pond, all in various stages of development. So some were in the mud, some were underwater, some were just buds, but there were a few that were opening and struggling to the surface of the water. And when he saw this, he had this vision. He recognized that it was for the sake of those with a little dust over their eyes, those struggling to the surface of the water, that he would preach the Dharma, that he would teach. So the appearance of Brahma Sahampati, the vision of the lotuses, again, it mythically represents the world almost pleading with the Buddha to teach the Dharma, because it needs the Dharma. We need the Dharma. We needed it then, and we need it now. So let's not confuse this with rational decision making, okay? The Buddha's vision of the lotuses was a true seeing of the human condition. Just as Siddhartha became the Buddha, so too we have the potential within us for growth towards enlightenment. And of course, we will be at different stages in that process. But it's the growth, this growth towards enlightenment is the meaning, it's the purpose of our life. And in that sense, the Buddha is the first fully opened lotus. And from the Buddha's true seeing of the human condition, from wisdom at its fullest, compassion in its fullest form arose. The compassion of a Buddha is directed towards all beings who are not yet enlightened, who are suffering from their craving, aversion, delusion. So born out of compassion is a spontaneous response to do whatever, to whatever is needed to alleviate the suffering of others, to share the Dharma, which is essentially about leading people from a state of suffering to a state of non-suffering. And such a compassion can only arise when there is no longer the illusion of this fixed, permanent self. There is no division between self and other. There's just a vision of human potential for growth, for awakening. So again, there's so much that we could pull out about this, about what this means to us. And I certainly don't have the time to do that. But I was thinking about this. One thing that kind of really grabbed me was this, for me, probably as somebody who can be very rationally minded, who has been taught to be, who has been trained to be, and realizing that there have been times in my life when that has just got out of the way, and when that gets out of the way, something else arises that I can't explain. I can't explain it, and in some senses, I don't even want to try and explain it, because explanation itself, I don't know, it reduces it, doesn't it, to the rational, the conceptual, and it's beyond that. And so, yeah, maybe when I heard Lionel Blue, something cut through to me. I don't know. I think it was there the first time I bowed to the Buddha. But it's been on there on so many other occasions when I've just felt like for a few moments, I've kind of just got out of the way. I've come back again, but I've just got out of the way. I think after that first retreat, the kind of quite rapid changes I made in my life, I just kind of knew that I had to kind of move from where I was living in Guildford to live in community. Later when I left my job, I knew that I had to do that, and it just arose out of meditation. And obviously asking for ordination, it just wasn't a rational, analytical, thought-out decision. It came from somewhere else. Maybe you have had those experiences as well and recognise it. I think we should treasure them. Back to the Buddha. So knowing he would teach, he began to ponder who he would teach. He recalled his early days of wandering and his two teachers, who, although they had not been able to show him the path to enlightenment, had taught him much on his way. We learnt about them last week. And so he wondered whether they would be able to understand what he had to teach. But then the Buddha, with his kind of infinite wisdom, knew that both men were dead. Then his mind alighted on his five former disciples. Now, these five former disciples as you may know, had left him in disgust when he decided to give up the kind of practicing of austerities and had begun to eat. And he recalled that although they had deserted him, they had been so very helpful to him before. And so he decided he would share his discovery with them. So his consideration about who should hear his first Dharma teaching was motivated by an understanding above who might be ready to hear the teachings, sorry, but also by a deep sense of gratitude, both to his former teachers, but also his former disciples. And again, it just makes me want to stop and ponder for a moment. Well, who do we feel gratitude for? And I kind of certainly know it might be easy to feel gratitude for those who have taught and guided us and love us. I certainly know that I feel gratitude towards those people. But are we also able to feel gratitude towards those people who might have rejected us, might have let us down, might not have believed in us? Can we still see their potential for human growth and not turn our back on them? Because that's what the Buddha was doing. The Buddha didn't hold a grudge against them. Now, I don't have time to go into detail, and I certainly don't think I need to, but I certainly recognise that the development of gratitude is, has, and continues to be a fundamental part of my spiritual progress. Hence, it was in a spirit of gratitude and desire to communicate all he had learnt and experienced that he set off 7 weeks after gaining enlightenment, determined to find his 5 previous followers, who he determined were a place about 100 miles away from where he was. So it probably took him about a week to get there. And we're told there's lots of stories about along the way he met people, some who just failed to see who he was and so forth. However, he eventually found his 5 former disciples, the 5 ascetics, in the local deer park. And as he approached, they kind of recognised him as their former teacher, even though now he looked decidedly well-fed and healthy. Indeed, they took this as a further sign of his weakness, of his failure, and decided that they weren't going to take any notice of him because he had wandered off the path to which they were still committed to. Yet, as the Buddha came nearer and nearer to them, it was impossible for them to keep their resolution. It was as if some unknown force beyond themselves compelled them to kind of get up and meet him, to pay respect to him, to offer him a seat. They still clung to their belief that he'd betrayed their ideal, yet they simultaneously recognised that he was different from before, but also different to anyone else they had previously encountered. They had no choice but to respond to him with both respect and to listen to what he had to say. Now, despite this compulsion to listen, they didn't kind of give up their resistance straight away. They were still convinced that his giving up of the practice of austerities indicated he was weak-willed. However, we're told that the Buddha persisted, and over a period of 2 months, the rainy season in that part of India, they slowly began to listen to what he had to say, to understand the significance of what he was saying. And we're told that by the end of the rainy season, all 5 disciples had understood what the Buddha was saying. They too had gained enlightenment. So the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma had occurred. Now, we don't really know for sure what the Buddha taught on this momentous occasion, but we can be pretty sure that he taught about suffering and an end to suffering, the essence of the Dharma, which I'm sure we'll hear more about tomorrow night. But for now, I just want to finish by drawing out that not only was this the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma, but it was also the very first ever Buddhist retreat. And furthermore, it was the origins of the Buddhist Sangha, the spiritual community made up of the disciples and the followers of the Buddha. And that's pretty amazing as I look around us now on retreat together. Because here we are some 2,600 years later on retreat, some of us here for the first time on retreat, for others it's not. But in some ways that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter because we're all here together now, aren't we? There's no one else is going to join us. We're here for the next few days together, living together. We're practicing together. We're hearing about the Dharma. We're learning how to be a community. We're learning how to be a Sangha. And I find that truly, truly inspiring. I find it every time on this retreat, I find it truly inspiring how we come together and do that. And yeah, it takes me back to my first retreat 10 years ago. It takes me back to the first time I knelt and bowed to the Buddha. But it also takes me back to, in my imagination, to the first retreat ever. And I kind of just wonder, I just wonder and imagine what that might have been like. So I just want to leave you with this idea of Sangha. Sangha of the past, but also this Sangha right here and now. And really to kind of invite you to open up as fully as possible to the kind of unique opportunity we have over the next few days. Yeah, to meditate, to listen to the Dharma, to live together in this kind of supportive, potentially life-changing, if we let it be, context. To experience what that means for you, because I kind of know how much it means to me. Because alongside the Buddha jewel and the Dharma jewel, the Sangha jewel, symbolised by the colour red, hence the ribbons, has helped me to kind of change the direction that my life was taking. And I just leave with the idea that all three come together. All three come together. We can't just have one. We have to have all three. We can't pick and choose. We have to have the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Thank you.